a trusted voice of truth and light.
God gave me a gift. I shovel well. I shovel very well.
And a rally point for those who've accepted the reality that they are not sheep.
We've got a blind date with destiny.
And it looks like she's ordered the lobster.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Well, hello there and welcome to the show. Whether you are a longtime wrong thinker or just wrong think curious, I'm glad you're with us today. And what you're going to find is that this is a place where truth does not violate our community standards. In fact, it's encouraged, even though it may sometimes be uncomfortable, occasionally painful. We're all about seeking truth here. I don't claim to have cornered the market on truth, but I'm doing my level best to ask the kinds of questions and explore the possibilities that will help you and I better see the world, as well as better understand who we are and what we stand for, as opposed to simply being, you know, given talking points as to here's who or what we're angry about today. We've always got a lot of great material. I am thankful for sponsors who make this program possible, including governyourincome.com, sewingandquiltingcenter.com, HSLAmmo.com, the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage, lifesavingfood.com, and MonticelloCollege.org. So, to begin today, I thought I would share with you the most recent essay from Paul Rosenberg. I love this guy's writings, and I think he has a lot of practical advice, but I think what I love most is his approach is not dogmatic. It's not wrapped in anger, and it's not wrapped in fear. There's a lot of practicality in what he advises, but there's also a gentleness here, and there's light, and that's what I find very, very useful. And he has an essay out here about dealing with violence, which I don't know about you. I mean, as kids, we were taught, you know, you never hit somebody. That's bad, bad, bad. But there are times when violence is appropriate, but the problem is most people don't know when those times are because they've never really experienced it. Now, the exception to this rule would be someone who has studied any of the martial arts, whether you learned boxing, whether you learned jiu-jitsu or, you know, karate or taekwondo or anything like this. People who have actually learned about and experienced it. In other words, if you've been punched, if you have been choked out, if you've been given a good judo throw, you know what it's like to be on the receiving end of violence. And this also helps you to better understand those times when it's appropriate as opposed to when it isn't. I strongly recommend anybody who wants to, you know, get themselves or their kids into a place where they can learn to trust their own judgment. Study martial arts. It's not going to go make you, you know, some, you know, I'm just trying to think of who would be a good, they won't make you Walker, Texas Ranger. Okay, it's not going to turn you into somebody who's out there kicking butts in every episode, but it will turn you into somebody who has skill as well as confidence in knowing, look, worst comes to worst, I can handle myself, but you also understand that there are times where it may be appropriate. But let's go to Paul Rosenberg's essay. He says, look, I advocate keeping children as far as possible from violence, even from the concept of violence, for as long as possible. It's simply not good for them. Unfortunately, he says, our world, while it certainly has beautiful parts, also contains violence. And so children will run into it at some point. Now, he says, just to reiterate, I'm kind of a purist on this. I think kids should be kept away even from violent heroes. Nonetheless, violence will make its appearance, and children should be prepared. So he says, today's installment shouldn't apply to young children, but it will to older children. Now, he says, one of the first things to understand about violence is that it never proves anyone right or wrong. Now, people portray it that way, but it's a ridiculous concept. Having better weapons or faster fists means absolutely nothing about being right or wrong, because you're talking about primitive force and nothing else. And yet sometimes, he says, primitive force does matter. I mean, we certainly have to use it against wild animals. Sensible cooperation with them simply isn't possible. And sadly, there are people with whom reasonable cooperation isn't possible. There really are human predators. Now, not terribly many, thankfully, but they do exist. Paul Rosenberg writes, violence does not come naturally to us. Our mental and emotional systems don't react well to it. And the people who are particularly good at violence are people who have been hardened by it. But he says they'd be better and happier if they hadn't had those experiences. Nearly all of us encountering violence for the first time are simply unprepared. We freeze in place, we run or hide. That's just what happens to most of us. But it's not important that we've been frozen by fear, because we can also get over it. Think of an old person you knew who was facing death, maybe a grandparent. They knew they were going to die. And how much worse is death than a punch? Did your grandparent lie in bed, shivering and screaming in fear for weeks or months? No. They got over it. They might not have liked the situation, but they were able to process the fear, and his point is, you can too. So if and when a moment of violence comes, he says your job is to stop questioning yourself. You must think only of the objective, letting that drive your body. And yes, that is animal-level thinking, because that's what violence is. Animal stuff. If violence comes, think of nothing except subduing your enemy. And if there's nothing you can do about the situation, you're just going to have to get through it. And if that means, and that means stopping your normal questioning processes and serving only the goal of your enemy being soundly defeated. Now that's ugly, because violence is ugly. Now he says, before getting back to a few specifics, remember, it's far better to avoid violence than to deal with it. Even if you're supremely ready for it, violence is always a damaging waste. Stay away from it. Pay attention to your surroundings. Don't let questionable people drag you along with them. And get the heck away if things start to worry you. Now from here he goes into a discussion of the bully's weapon. And points out that predators know if they can make you afraid, they are in control of you. And how do they know this? Well, because they've lived through it themselves, and probably many times. Every bully has been abused in one way or another. Now they want to impose their pain upon you. And they know by experience that once they were frightened, they were disarmed, and then they were beaten. So the bully gets relief from the memory of his own weakness and pain by abusing others. His or her cruelty springs from weakness and fear. And you see the corollary to this? Strength and compassion, or strength and wholeness, rather, are what give us compassion. You don't have anything to prove. So when a predator decides to prey upon someone, the first thing they do is intimidate them. They want to see fear before they proceed. A bully will almost always test their victim before attacking. Now, so if someone is too intrusive or threatening, and your instincts start to make noise, you have a predator on your hands. He's testing you to see if you'll be easy to beat. Ignoring the test is a sign of fear. Denying that the predator is there, the head-in-the-sand tactic, is exactly what he's looking for. Hardened predators see reasonableness and kindness as weakness. They believe that no one would show kindness unless he or she had to. Now, running away may not help either. It's another indication to the predator that you can be taken. So in the twisted mind of a predator, there exist two primary classes of human beings, predators and victims, and there's very little in between. So when a predator starts to feel a bit weak, he has to intimidate or abuse someone else just to prove that he or she is not in the victim class. Predators who want their props have a good reason for it. To accept disrespect identifies them as victims, and that means other predators will start circling. Also, bear in mind that there are many people who grow up in predatory cultures. This is the only way they know of viewing the world. Now, that's not to excuse them, but we should understand what, in fact, they are. Paul Rosenberg says, if someone sees all the world as a predator and prey, then you have no hope of talking them out of it, and you cannot allow a predator to dictate your actions. So he says, before we go through the classic confrontation, like the bully in the bar, let's start with this. If you're in a nasty enough place to encounter a bully looking to prove something, you're either exceptionally unlucky or you've gotten yourself into a stupid situation. Use some common sense and you'll avoid these wasteful experiences. That said, a bully in a bar is almost a perfect setup for an intimidation. Not only can the bully surprise you, but he can make you feel multiple types of fear. Beyond the fear, the obvious fear of a beating, he can also make you afraid of looking weak in front of your friends or potential mates. Now from here he goes into three rules for dealing with bullies. And unfortunately, I'm going to leave you with a bit of a cliffhanger here for a moment because we are coming up fast on our break. Look, it's a reality. You're going to encounter bullies at some point in life. And it doesn't mean that you got to puff up and be bigger and badder and more violent and, you know, more threatening. You know, you need more tattoos, you need more piercings, you need, you know, more openly worn weapons, chains and the like. No. Because so much of it just takes place in between your ears. So we'll come back with Paul Rosenberg's three rules for dealing with bullies. I think you're going to find these very useful. Should you have the bad fortune to encounter a bully? We'll also talk about some of the different kinds of bullying. It's all straight ahead. Stay with us.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. We're talking about dealing with violence, and that often entails dealing with bullies. Got a great essay here from Paul Rosenberg. I've got it linked in my show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. If you find yourself on my show notes page, take a second and hit that subscribe button, and I will save you the trouble of having to search it out. I will put it in your email inbox each morning that I do this program. It's a great opportunity to dig a little bit deeper into some of the topics of things that are going on around us and to further educate yourself, further strengthen yourself in terms of your ability to sort fact from fiction. So Paul Rosenberg's three rules for dealing with bullies. These are pretty simple and straightforward. Number one, show no fear. Now, feeling fear is not a real problem. It's just don't show it. Secondly, do not insult or challenge the bully. And number three, give them an exit that doesn't require them to accept the status of victim. So here's how that works. This is what it looks like in application. Paul Rosenberg says we all feel fear and it's just an unfortunate inheritance. So absorb the fear and learn how to hold a straight face. Now he says this is difficult and unpleasant, but life on earth is a long way from what it should be. Sorry. Also, he says, do not allow yourself to say, well, maybe it's not that bad, because it is that bad. A predator is preparing to crush you. Many of us have an instinct to deny things that are too unpleasant, but you must not allow it. Denial will make it almost certain that you get hurt. Your attitude should be, well, crap, I'm in a bad situation with no easy escape. I'll have to do the right things to get through it. Now, if a predator tries to intimidate with words, go ahead and answer them, but do so as an equal. Assert yourself. You may actually have to fight. Now, that stinks, but even in this case, showing no fear is your first blow against the bully. Think of it this way. The predator sees you as a likely victim and tries to scare you. That's his first blow, trying to make you afraid. You answer him firmly. That's your return blow. He's now lost his advantage. In this scenario, even if the bully does attack, he's doing so with a divided mind, and that's a big disadvantage for him. So by answering the bully, you are weakening him immediately. Now, when it comes to facing fears alone, here's one more thing to keep in mind. When you face threats by yourself, we experience high levels of stress hormones. Like it or not, useful or not, that's how the human body operates. But when we face threats in groups, our stress hormones rise to only a fraction of the solitary level. This is why armies keep men in tight units. Maybe you've noticed this in your own life. If not, try to imagine walking all alone through the dark woods at night, then hearing an animal noise behind you. Would you feel better if you had a friend or two with you? Preferably one who runs slower than you. I'm just kidding. If you're anything close to average, yes, you'd feel better knowing you have someone there for you. Now, why we are this way doesn't really matter, but Paul Rosenberg says we are that way. Our minds are less effective when grouped with others, but our stress hormones are more placid. Ah, well. Interesting read. Paul Rosenberg, dealing with violence. Now, I'm sure there will be others, again, particularly martial artists, who'll say, hey, how could this be? You know, this is, you just got to do this move and say these words, and this is going to solve the situation. I don't know that there's any one size fits all approach, but I think his basic premise is very, very sound. When someone is trying to make you afraid, don't show them that you're afraid. And even though you may feel fear, which is a very natural reaction, you can work through it. Remember, courage is what you do, not what you feel. All right, I'm going to move on. I thought that was a really interesting article. Now, let's see. I don't know if you followed the recent testy exchanges between Senator Rand Paul and Dr. Anthony Fauci. They've been going on for a while, but they've been definitely worth keeping an eye on. And I would emphasize, this is not just a personality clash. This is the epic struggle of a bureaucrat trying desperately to duck accountability. And there's a terrific article. Phil Magnus and James R. Harrington have put together a marvelous article about Fauci emails and some alleged science. I mean, just the title right there is enough to pull me in. Dr. Fauci he's been on the hot seat, and yet he's very, very good at avoiding actually taking a stand. It's always, you don't understand what you're talking about. I wouldn't do anything like that. Anyway, the article says from October, this is from Phil Magnus and also James R. Harrington, James R. Harrigan, my apologies, James, from the American Institute for Economic Research. And it says from October 2nd through the 4th, 2020, the American Institute for Economic Research hosted a small conference for scientists to discuss the COVID-19 lockdowns. Now, just 4 days later, Dr. Francis Collins, the retiring director of the National Institutes of Health, would call three of the scientists in attendance fringe epidemiologists in a directive he sent to Anthony Fauci and other senior staff of his agency. Now, they were fringe epidemiologists because they had the temerity to ask whether the lockdowns of 2020 were effective. And the three of them, Martin Kulldorff of Harvard, Sunetra Gupta of Oxford, Jay Bhattacharya of Stanford, were simply doing what any good scientist would do, and that is following the evidence. They wrote the Great Barrington Declaration as they parted company at AIER and then posted it for all to see. So why exactly was Dr. Collins so intent on impugning these three scientists? Well, it's hard to know, mostly because any scientist worth his salt should have been happy to see further research being done. That is, after all, how ignorance is replaced by knowledge. But Collins was clearly in no mood to replace his own possible ignorance with any kind of knowledge. He was pretty sure he knew all he had to know, and this is one of the most dangerous positions a scientist can take. In an email obtained by AIER through a Freedom of Information Act request, Collins told Anthony Fauci, CCing Lawrence Tabak, Deputy Ethics Director Counselor at NIH, that he wanted a quick and devastating published takedown of the Great Barrington Declaration's premises. And they actually have posted a little, screenshot of what that looked like. Now, one wonders, why would he CC the Deputy Ethics Counselor on this, given the trouble people seem to have with ethics, or at least these people seem to have? But they were in October of 2020, and Fauci wrote that same night to let Collins know there was already a devastating takedown of the Great Barrington Declaration in that August scientific publication, Wired. Francis, Fauci wrote, I am pasting in below a piece from Wired that debunks the Great Barrington Declaration. Their science reporter, Matt Reynolds, told us there was no scientific divide over herd immunity, but that's not the funny part. The funny part came when Reynolds declared quite confidently that we no longer had anything to worry about, as lockdowns were, as of October 2020, a thing of the past. The problem with the Great Barrington Declaration is that we aren't in lockdown, Reynolds explained. It's hard to find people who are advocating for a return to the lockdown we saw in March. When the Great Barrington Declaration authors declare their opposition to lockdowns, they are quite literally arguing with the past. That's a direct quote. Now, this Fauci-endorsed passage may be one of the worst takes of the entire pandemic. Less than a month later, lockdowns came roaring back with a vengeance. And Fauci wrote to Collins the next day, this time referencing a breathless op-ed by Greg Gonsalves, a public health professor at Yale in The Nation. And here we arrive at yet another funny part. Gonsalves' article wasn't exactly a critique of the Great Barrington Declaration. Instead, Gonsalves went after Martin Kulldorff, who in an interview with the leftist magazine Jacobin quite reasonably pointed out that lockdowns hurt the poor more than most talking heads were willing to admit. So Gonsalves' grievance was that by interviewing Kulldorff, Jacobin had broken the lockdown solidarity of other far-left websites, including The Nation and Boston Review. Why do they need such uniformity to maintain their narrative? Isn't the truth enough? We'll be back in just a moment.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for engaging in Wrong Think on this beautiful day. And thanks for being part of our growing audience of wrong thinkers around the world. No, no joke. Yeah, we're starting to pick up some international audience. I think it's only 5% of my audience at this point is outside the United States, but hey, it's a start. You know, if I'm going to be subversive, I guess I'd like to be subversive worldwide. So here we go. By the way, our program is brought to you by great sponsors like lifesavingfood.com. Straightforward, I'm just going to tell you, food storage is a great idea. It's a great way to know that you have the confidence of being able to handle unforeseen circumstances, disasters, just unexpected downturns or setbacks. It's nice to know that you can stand on your own feet and you're not dependent on either the kindness of strangers or some bureaucrat to take care of you. So check out the website that I link to in my show notes. That's lifesavingfood.com. 15% discount on anything you order. No sales tax. Free delivery. It'll save you some money right up front there. Okay, back to the article. This is from Phil Magnus and James R. Harrigan. They are both from the American Institute for Economic Research. And it's about Fauci emails and some alleged science. Why was it so important that Dr. Fauci, among others, work to try to discredit the Great Barrington Declaration founders? And it's not like the Great Barrington Declaration doctors, those three doctors that had signed their names to it, Martin Kulldorff and also Jay Bhattacharya and Sunetra Gupta. They weren't out there, you know, parading around trying to get, you know, attention and book deals and movie and action figures, you know, like Dr. Fauci. They were just simply questioning, is there a better way for us to address this pandemic than by destroying people's lives? Shouldn't we be protecting the more vulnerable and letting other people live their lives knowing that the risk to the healthy is very, very minor? Those who get the virus have a 99%+ chance of surviving it. The odds are very much in your favor, if we can use some Hunger Games parlance here. But it was super important to Dr. Fauci and others, Francis Collins from the National Institutes of Health, for instance, to discredit and put these guys down. I'm sorry, these guys and this gal down. So by October 10th, the lines were well drawn. Fauci had thrust himself into the middle of the media hootenanny that was clearly emerging. Again, this is October 10th of 2020. Collins emailed again to boast about calling the three scientists fringe in the Washington Post. Although he told Fauci that their ongoing campaign to take down the Great Barrington Declaration will not be appreciated in the White House. Now remember, Trump was still president at this time. Fauci retorted the White House was too busy with other things to worry about the Great Barrington Declaration. There was an election to deal with, after all. And as the bedfellows became more strange, Greg Gonsalves wrote directly to Collins, thanking him for his undiplomatic approach. For his part, Gonsalves became ever more hostile and profane in his remarks on the Great Barrington Declaration. "This effing Great Barrington Declaration is like a bad rash that won't go away," Gonsalves tweeted shortly after reaching out to Collins. A day earlier, the Yale professor also began promoting unhinged conspiracy theories about the Great Barrington Declaration and American Institute for Economic Research, that traced to the blog of a former 9/11 Truther Movement activist. Now, some of the emails between Collins and Fauci sent in response to AIER's Freedom of Information Act request have been redacted. But the surrounding context makes it pretty clear they were looking for a way to impugn the Great Barrington Declaration further if it came up at the White House COVID Task Force meeting on October 16th. Well, that morning, Fauci emailed Deborah Birx, the White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator, and he pressed the need for her to oppose the Great Barrington Declaration and set the stage for an attack on Scott Atlas, who was the most friendly champion of the Great Barrington Declaration on that White House task force. Well, Fauci, it turns out, had to miss the October 16th task force meeting, though he likely breathed a sigh of relief when Collins emailed him 2 days later. Atlas did not take part in the task force meeting on Friday, Collins wrote, and the Great Barrington Declaration did not come up. Another partially redacted email hints that Fauci celebrated this outcome. Atlas's opposition to the lockdown faction on the task force is driving Deb Birx crazy, he continued. Fauci and Collins weren't done, though, in their campaign to take down those Great Barrington Declaration scientists. Our story picks up again in earnest on November 2nd, when Fauci's chief of staff, Greg Folkers, replied to an email that was not made public in pursuance to that Freedom of Information Act request. Now, it seems pretty clear, though, that Fauci asked Folkers for a list of sources that would allow him to argue effectively against the Great Barrington Declaration. The email subject line references a previous correspondence from Fauci as discussed, noting that Folkers had highlighted the three I found most useful. Multiple sources, and particularly Scott Atlas's recently published account of his time on the task force, have noted that Fauci often relies on aides to curate lists of sources in advance of his many media appearances. He seldom reads the scientific literature on COVID-19 himself and instead arrives at meetings with staff-prepared talking points. And it appears that Folker's email was an answer to one such request for talking points to attack the Great Barrington Declaration scientists. Now note that Fauci frequently portrays himself as a staunch defender of science who stays above the political divide and remains outside of the partisan debates. See, in light of that, you might expect that Folker's response to Fauci's request would yield a small sample of scientific analysis on the logic behind the lockdowns, even if only in a format bullet pointed by his staff. But you'd be wrong. Folker sent Fauci a list of 7 political op-eds and articles opposing the Great Barrington Declaration from popular media outlets. So yeah, science. Great article here, and lots of links within it to back up what Philip W. Magnus and also James R. Harrigan are saying here. If you haven't subscribed to AIER's website or to their daily newsletter that comes out and their emails, you really should. AIER.org. They have been a fabulous source of information on COVID, but also just on economics in general and a lot of the things going on. This is one of the most nonpartisan outfits that I like to turn to when I want to get a really solid take. That doesn't mean, by the way, that I agree with everything that I read, but I believe that their writers are far more honest and far more motivated by putting truth above party than almost any other source out there. There are some great sources. This is one of the best. So I highly, highly recommend it. All right, shifting gears once again. Every day we have been seeing more evidence that the people who've been calling the shots on lockdowns and vaccine mandates have been terribly wrong. This is why this matters. Why were they so anxious to take down the Great Barrington Declaration when now, a year and a half later, well, actually not quite a year and a half, but well over a year later, you have scientists and doctors and bureaucrats starting to admit, okay, maybe what we should do is we should, protect the vulnerable and realize that government itself cannot control this virus, which is what the Great Barrington Declaration was saying all along. I don't know what it is, but something about people in power, they can't admit they were wrong. It would destroy the illusion why society would collapse if people thought that we couldn't be trusted. Well, it's long past time for these people to stand up and be truthful. In fact, Jeff M. Lewis has some very simple, honest questions about COVID-19. And see, even mentioning this, I have a little hesitation because it's like, okay, this is going to get me flagged, and probably I've had one warning from YouTube. Haven't had a strike yet, but I'm sure it's coming. But I'm not living up to community standards, because these are the kind of questions that are inconvenient. They point out that there are holes in the narrative and that there are things that don't add up. I like how Jeff Lewis approaches this. He says, in July of 2021, I wrote about the quest for truth in our worldwide battle against SARS-CoV-2 virus and the resulted COVID-19 illness. Now, he says, I'm neither a physician, medical professional, nor a scientist, so nothing I write should be construed as medical advice or peer-reviewed opinion. But he says, I am a college-educated, mature senior citizen, or American citizen, rather, who strives to stay informed and actively seeks alternative sources of information, and occasionally consumes the evening's propaganda ministry broadcast just to keep up with their side of the story. Lewis says, I consider myself able to understand and apply fundamental scientific concepts, principles, and laws to daily life. See, he's confident enough to at least ask the questions. But he says, after observing what's happening, the never-ending hysteria, the fear-mongering, the stifling of any dissent to the approved narrative, it's time to start asking more simple, honest questions. We're going to come back to his questions, just the other side of these messages. Stay with us.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Welcome back to the show. Remember, my goal here is not to make you fearful. It's not to bring more anger to an already volatile climate. I want to just help you find your way out of the swamp of misinformation. And that doesn't mean we have to agree on everything. It just means we're both working our way, you know, out of all the distortions and things which are meant to keep us in the dark, and hopefully finding our way to solid ground. Some folks have been slogging along here for a long time. They've left trail markers along the way for those of us who are following. We should be doing likewise for the people who are behind us. And I'm very grateful for the article that I'm sharing right now from Jeff M. Lewis, Simple, Honest Questions About COVID-19. Jeff Lewis says, I can't begin to tell you how many times I've engaged those who tenaciously adhere to the approved narrative about our medical establishment's response to the pandemic and been told, you're not a scientist, you don't understand. He says, I conversed with a doctoral degree candidate at a major university. She disagreed so vehemently with medical doctors who have decades of experience and are in positions of immense responsibility at medical centers across the country that she called them quacks because they supported the preventative and therapeutic use of hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. To this PhD candidate who called herself a scientist, ivermectin is antiparasitic only, and a horse dewormer that should never, ever be prescribed to humans. Now, would the reader agree that it's become particularly tiresome hearing from all the experts who continue to be wrong and continue to move the goalposts? Jeff Lewis says, for me, it's especially infuriating that the responses to simple, honest questions are usually ad hominem attacks instead of reasoned, rational, respectful, and honest discussions about the issues at hand. Since when is the science ever settled? Since when is the science a consensus? And since when does a scientist ever stop asking questions? Not only to prove a hypothesis, but also in an honest and courageous attempt to disprove it. And by proving that the hypothesis is wrong, to advance scientific inquiry. Doesn't the scientific method employ both strategies to arrive at the most accurate outcomes and the more certain knowledge? Isn't that the best science? He says, given that our knowledge is neither infallible nor immutable, why are we routinely expected to accept the science as infallible and immutable? In other words, settled. Jeff Lewis says it's a fact that those who have had both shots plus the booster are testing positive for COVID and are getting sick. Can we now conclude the virus is mutated and is escaping the vaccine? Can we now conclude that widely administering the mRNA vaccines to the general population instead of limited distribution to those at highest risk has been a failed strategy? Can we now conclude that the SARS-CoV-2 virus has mutated and each successive variant is less susceptible to the vaccine, and maybe making vaccine recipients more susceptible to becoming sick with COVID? Since when, in the course of the history of medical science, has a patient been required to get 3 doses of a vaccine, yet he still remains at risk of contracting the very illness for which the patient has been vaccinated? Were 3 doses of the polio vaccine required while still leaving the person at risk of contracting polio, smallpox, measles, mumps, yellow fever, Bueller, anyone? Jeff Lewis asks, why has the FDA rushed the emergency use authorization of the vaccine for children? Children are among those who are the least at risk of becoming seriously ill or dying from the Wuhan lab virus and its variants. Does anyone know why? Why would we as a nation or as parents allow our children to be injected with an experimental vaccine for an illness that poses a less than 1 in a million chance of serious illness or death among children, even as it's been proven not to be effective against the latest, most widespread variant? He says the current White House occupant continually refers to the pandemic of the unvaccinated and has mandated that all federal employees and 85 million other employees get the vaccine. Yet those who have dutifully been fully vaccinated and boosted are now becoming ill with COVID. How then can it be a pandemic of the unvaccinated? Is the White House occupant referring to his own super spreader campaign and the nearly 2 million unvaccinated and untested illegal immigrants who entered our country since January 20th of 2021 and who have been stealthily spirited by his administration to locales and municipalities across the country? Does he mean those unvaccinated? No. See, if this administration was serious about shutting down the virus, Biden would secure the border. He says, allow me to offer an analogy. Those who serve now and have served in the armed forces of the United States have been trained to fight America's enemies, to fight and never surrender of our own free will while we have the means to continue fighting. This means that while there are weapons, ammunition, and warriors to use them, it is our duty to fight. Now he says, as a veteran, then I look at every dietary supplement, every vitamin, every medicine that has the potential to be effective as a weapon in this fight against the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And I want all who are able to use them in this fight. So why have the CDC, the National Institute of Health, the FDA, and every other agency, the alphabet soup of our big government medical bureaucracies, not focused at all on prevention? In other words, diet, fitness, reducing obesity, educating the public about how to strengthen and fortify their natural immunity so as not to get COVID in the first place. He says we must effectively employ the preventative measures, therapies and medicines, the weapons we have now. When people are dying, physicians must not be restricted to only those medicines that have completed a peer-reviewed, double-blind, blue-ribbon study and then are authorized only for narrowly defined and specific use. Does anyone remember that in 2020 we were facing the novel, meaning new, coronavirus? Now as then, we need to fight against the variants of this new virus with the weapons/medicines that are effective, as the off-label use of hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin has demonstrated in the United States and other countries. And this is the burning question. Why are these FDA-approved medicines, both of which have been safely prescribed for decades, restricted from our general use in the fight against COVID? For that matter, why is Anthony Fauci, you know, advocating that the post office seize people's shipments of ivermectin that are being mailed to them? Jeff Lewis asks, why are we myopically insisting that we only use one weapon? In hindsight, the vaccines haven't been employed as they should have been, and now have been rendered largely ineffective at reducing the spread of COVID-19. Why do we continue with this failed strategy? He says, we've always known it is in any and every virus's nature to evolve and mutate in order to survive. Have we lost sight of this basic lesson of medical science? He says, I'm sure the reader also has many simple, honest questions of their own. There are many doctors and scientists of goodwill and intention working in good faith to answer simple, honest questions. We must be persistent in asking them. We must be persistent in demanding answers. I'll have a link to his commentary in today's show notes. I hope you'll check it out. Something else I'm going to throw in here, and this is just this is something for you to consider. Well, actually, I may save this to the next hour. We're coming up fast. I've talked about fourth-turning historical cycles. I'm going to share some excerpts coming up in the next hour from Jim Quinn, who writes for theburningplatform.com. Holy cow, does this guy have some amazing insights on what's going on and how the fourth-turning historical cycle that's currently playing out in front of us is building to its climax. It's fascinating stuff. It's a little bit daunting because we've been through this before. If you want to go back about 80 years or so, the climax of the last fourth turning was the Great Depression and World War II. And World War II, I mean, that was a pretty bloody climax. Prior to that, the fourth turning before that would have been the Civil War and Reconstruction. Prior to that, it was the American Revolution and founding period. Now, I guess the good news is you can look back and say, okay, but we survived all of those turnings. And it's true, we did. So the question that's before us is, will we be better off or worse off as this next turning plays out? And I don't have the answer for that. Nobody does at this point because it's not predictable. Like, well, if we just hold our nose this way and put one hand in the air, everything's going to be just fine. There's still a lot of stuff in motion. But this much we can know for sure, when the dust settles on the other side of that fourth turning, things are going to look very different. I'm going to be doing everything in my power to make sure that it's a positive change as opposed to a negative one. And I would encourage you to do likewise.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.